Okay, so I want to go over a few announcements, and then we'll jump back and look at the GPU architecture that we had from last week, and then we'll start talking a little bit about CUDA. Hey, do you have a question? Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, good. Okay, so Project Zero is due tomorrow, anytime tomorrow. If you didn't get instructions for doing the pull request, I'll have Carl send those back out. But I hope that everyone was able to get their stuff built and running. So that's I know it's not the easiest stuff to get running, but once we get that hurdle behind us, then we can start doing actual fun stuff. And then we're going to release Project 1 either today or tomorrow. And if we release it tomorrow, we'll push back the due date a day. But it's going to be on GPU ray tracing. So I assume many, if not all of you, wrote a ray tracer in 460/560. And we're going to write a smaller ray tracer, but we're going to do it on the GPU with, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of threads. So it'll all be done in parallel. It'll be very fast. I think it'll be really cool. It'll be a good base for your following project, which will be a path tracer. And, yep?
I was just wondering, I'm having a Quadro FX card, which has a very less number of groups.
So it's just going to... So we'll actually talk about that a little bit today, but it will just be a lot slower. But it should still work. Like your code will still.
It has this, like, 32 cores.
It has 32 cores.
Yeah,
that's almost nothing. But okay.
I thought it was one of the line cards. It was also expensive, so I thought it was
going to
be good.
Yeah, the Quadro card. Did you get a while ago?
Yeah, like a couple of years.
Okay. So for NVIDIA, they have a GeForce line, and then they have a Quadro line. And the GeForce line is like gamer, you know, for games, and the Quadro line is their professional card. And really the differences, I mean, I assume there's several differences, but the Quadro cards, they're like really good at rendering lines, because a lot of CAD applications render lines, and they actually have different drivers. Depending on how you look at it, you could say that the GeForce drivers are crippled, or that the Quadro drivers are optimized for certain things, in particular for display lists, which is of part of OpenGL that we won't talk about because it no longer exists, except a lot of older like CAD apps still run on it. But so to answer your question, the Quadro should run your stuff, but if someone is saying they get 100 frames per second and you're getting 4 frames per second, it's not your code, it's probably your card. Let's see. Any other video card related questions? No? Okay, so for the first project, this is where we're going to start doing blogs. So I know I said on the first day that we used to do just blogs for a final project, but now we're going to do them semester long. And if you already have like a personal blog that's, you know, related to like technical stuff, you're welcome just to use that. But basically, every time you submit your project, we'll also just do one blog post with a short description, a little video, and a screenshot. And this way you can really start building like your online portfolio and get some practice writing too, which is important to me. And then I just want to emphasize, again, if you're going to use any third-party code, just run it by us. Just ask on Piazza. So this way, if you ask publicly and we say yes, everyone knows that they could use that. And, you know, my general rule of thumb is if it's not core to the assignment, chances are you're going to be able to use it. But if it's like, you know, I found this other ray tracer in the NVIDIA SDK. Can I submit this? The answer is no, obviously not. So that's it. I'm really looking forward to these ray tracers. This is the first time that we're doing them in this course as a project, and I think you guys will have really good results. So I'm going to jump back to the slides that we had from last week. And I'm going to skip. I know I'm going to go one slide ahead from where we were. I'm going to start with this diffuse reflectance shader. And this is our first look at a shader, which for now I'm just going to call it a small program that runs through every pixel on the screen and it determines its color. That is an imprecise and incomplete definition, but for the stuff we want to talk about today, I think it's going to be sufficient. So this particular shader here is written in HLSL, which is the high-level shading language. It's the shading language for Direct3D. We will be doing mostly GLSL in this course, which is OpenGL shading language. However, the syntax is very similar. I mean, you can mechanically change one to the other. They're very similar. So this particular shader What it does is it reads a texture, that's the myText.sample, and then it does a dot product with a light vector and a surface normal, so that's a diffuse component, and it multiplies the two. So it's a very simple diffuse reflecting shader. Right? Now, one reason that the GPU is so successful, or it's so successful as a parallel programming platform, is because it's parallel, and we don't even know it's parallel. Like, for the most part, from like the OpenGL user who's using the GPU for graphics, we just tell it to draw stuff, and the parallelism is implicit. It just invokes this massively parallel computer for us. But the code right here doesn't have any explicit parallelism. This is just one particular pixel on the screen. Here comes some data in about this pixel. We're going to compute a color and output it. Now, if this were a CPU, we might have an unshaded fragment. So do you guys know the difference between a fragment and a pixel? Right. Okay, so it's just a terminology, but it's good to get it right. So I'm starting off saying pixel because I'm sure it's familiar with you guys. A fragment is a pixel, that may or may not become a pixel depending on if it fails the depth test or not. So a pixel is a fragment until it's written to the frame buffer. So the terminology is a little unfortunate in that on Direct3D you'll hear pixel shaders, and on OpenGL you'll hear fragment shaders. The more precise term is fragment shaders, because as we'll learn, it's very possible that you'll run your code to shade a fragment, even though it might later pass the depth test. And in fact, if time permits, we'll probably have an entire lecture on how we can minimize that from happening, because it is a huge bottleneck. When you look at games or even most graphics today, all the work is being done in these fragment shaders, and if we can make them run less often, then we can improve the performance. But back to this little piece of code, you know, we have one fragment coming in, it gets colored, one fragment comes out. And on the right, I'm just showing some assembly. Don't worry about the details of the assembly language. Just know that this code was compiled into that assembly. And if we had a processor, a single CPU core executing this, here's our core on the left-hand side. It has three big blocks for the moment, a fetch and decode block that takes the instruction, and then it looks at the bits and decodes it and say, hey, what does this thing do? Which is then fed into the ALU to actually do the, to actually execute the instruction, whether it multiply and add, something like that. And then this execution context is a chunk of memory that you can just think of it as a bunch of registers. Maybe the registers and the instruction pointer would be good. This is stuff that we looked at a little bit last week. So here's a very simple CPU, and if it were to execute this shader, it would do so in sequence. But as we learned last week, there's a whole lot of things on the CPU to help improve the performance for a single instruction stream. A lot of it is cache, right? The core that we looked at, it was it 24.7% of it was L3 cache. There's lots of fancy control logic to do out-of-order execution to increase the scheduling window. There's lots of logic for doing branch prediction so that we don't have to stall the pipeline. And then they're also showing some memory prefetch here, again, to just improve the performance for a single instruction stream. Now, on a GPU, what we really care about is improving throughput. We don't care about one instruction stream. I mean, how many pixels are on the screen, right? Think of a 1920 by 1280. There's a whole lot of pixels that we have to shade, right? So the first big idea in GPU architecture is we'll get rid of anything that makes a single instruction stream run quickly. So for example, the cache, for right now, we're going to say the cache is gone. We'll see that we actually do introduce some caches later. But for right now, we're going to say we got rid of the cache, got rid of that out of order, got rid of the branch predictor, got rid of all that logic, because now we can use those transistors to really help us build a machine that's capable of parallelism. So we have now, we increased our transistor budget. So maybe we could make two cores, and now we could take two different instruction streams, two different programs completely, and we could shade two different fragments at the same time. Everyone comfortable with that? You know, but we actually, when we got rid of that cache and other things, we actually gave ourselves a lot of transistors. So maybe we could do, say, 4 at the same time. Or more likely, probably 16. So with this processor that we're looking at here, we have 16 cores. Each core processes one fragment and runs one independent instruction stream from every other fragment. So far, so good. Okay. But think of an image. Think of you're playing a game, and how many different programs for shading your fragments do you need to run at the same time? If you have a character, how many different shaders are going to be ran on it? You know, think of the skin, maybe the cloth. Think if you're shading this room, you have the blackboard. So it turns out that many of these fragments can share the same instruction stream. They're actually going to run the same program. You know, probably like your first, intro in 460, you probably only had one shader for the entire program, right? So here's our simple core. But the next big idea is that what we could do is we can take the fetch and decode logic for pulling an instruction out of memory and determining what to do with that instruction, and we can amortize it across many ALUs. And one thing that we did is we took the context, that memory that stores the registers, and we broke it up into several different contexts so we could have, say, a different register or a different set of registers for each thread. And you'll see this shared memory that we'll talk a lot about throughout the semester. So, like, when I say thread, is everyone comfortable with the idea of threads? So this is a separate instruction stream. Or right now, we might loosen that definition a little bit. But you can have more than one thing happening at the same time with threads. And the threads that we're going to see on the GPU are a lot different than they are in the CPU. In particular, we'll see a lot more of them, and they'll be a lot lighter weight in terms of initially launching them and switching and swapping them. Okay, so now we've changed our core such that we fetch and decode one instruction, and then we execute it across 8 different sets of data in this particular example. So here, now one core could take 8 fragments coming in, 8 fragments coming out. We're running the same program on each one, but we're going to have different data coming in and different data coming out. So you may hear this called SIMD, single instruction, multiple data, or you may also see it called SPMD, single program, multiple data. Although here it's showing you vector instructions, this isn't necessarily explicit vector instructions. In fact, on the NVIDIA hardware, it's not. And there's a slide later to clarify that. But now, if we took our original processor where we had 16 different processors that could do 16 different instruction streams, now what do we have? We can do 16 different instruction streams, but each one of them can do 8 fragments at the same time. So that's a total of 128 fragments that are all being able to execute in parallel. And I do want to step back and say that we have the luxury here at this point in the course that shading the fragments is embarrassingly parallel. Every fragment is independent of every other fragment. So they just go in parallel, just like, you have a highway, a 3-lane highway, and you got 3 cars on that highway. No one's blocking each other. They're just going. And then just to kind of loosen up our terminology, I'm saying fragments because that's probably the most dominant thing we think about in computer graphics, but it could also be vertices, right? To render a scene, we have to transform our vertices for our meshes from model coordinates into clip coordinates and eventually into window coordinates. Or it could be primitives, where we can actually run shaders that run on a single primitive and modifies it or perhaps removes it or creates new ones. And then we'll also see that this might not be anything at all to do with graphics. It might be a general purpose kernel, which we'll talk about hopefully in about a half hour or so with CUDA. Okay, so we amortize the cost of fetch and decode over several different sets of memory, right? So if we're running the same instruction over 8 different fragments, it's possible that the code has branches in it and the branches might diverge, meaning we have a group of 8 fragments And some of them take the true condition, some of them take the false condition. But we said that they're all going to execute in a SIMD fashion, where they're all going to run the same instruction. And that's how we're able to amortize the calls for the fetch and decode. So how do you guys think we would handle branches? What do you think is the most obvious and naive thing we could do to handle the branch?
Guess the majority.
Guess the majority? Yeah, so we got rid of that predictor, though. Right, the branch predictor, we said, oh, it's going to be too many transistors.
Execute both conditions.
So, what you're saying, split up the fragments so that they don't diverge? Is that what you're telling me? Now, you're like, oh, okay. So we will actually look at an optimization technique called warp partitioning, where we're going to organize our threads such that they don't, their if statements don't diverge. So all the threads, you know, all the eight fragments here, they all take one side of the branch, and then eight fragments might take the other side of the branch. And we'll see that we can actually get pretty good performance gain with like very sleight of hand changes to the code. Like if you didn't know about branch divergence and warp partitioning, I'd show you two algorithms, and from like a C programmer point of view, you'd be like, oh, they're so similar. I don't know why you would do this transformation. Yet you could get a really big performance gain. And we'll see a number of cases like that when it comes to optimizing for the GPU. But back to, what does a GPU usually do with these branches? It does execute both sides of them. So it will say, well, we're going to execute both sides, and then we're going to figure out which side should have ran. And we're going to go X that part out. The problem with this is if your branches diverge a lot inside this group of fragments, you wind up hurting performance. And it can be pretty bad, say if one goes true and the rest go false. So definitely when it comes to CUDA, we'll learn how to partition our warps, which are equivalently groups of threads, such that we minimize this. And in graphics, we're going to look at screen space coherence. So if we are rendering this room and we had one shader, one program to shade the fragments for the floor, and one for, say, the wall and the blackboard here, in screen space, so in the 2D screen, from most views, fragments next to each other are going to have the same shader. Can you guys kind of conceptualize that and see that? So the coherence between branches is going to be really good. But think of an example where maybe say we had a tree with a bunch of leaves, and that's casting a shadow. And then the ground, some of it is in shadow, some of it isn't, but it's going to be very sparse. And you might have a lot of really poor coherence there, and you might have a big problem with branch divergence. So we'll look more at this in the semester, but the real point here is, if you get a branch and it diverges, you execute both sides of it, and then you undo the one that, or you ignore the one that shouldn't have executed. Any questions? Okay, so this slide just clarifies, what I already said, which was the SIMD, even though we showed SIMD instructions earlier, the hardware isn't necessarily going to be SIMD. It can be implicit or explicit. Not a big deal. The biggest, but a huge point for today is we got rid of those caches. So what are we going to do when we have to go to main memory, right? So main memory can be definitely hundreds of cycles. It is very slow compared to compute. And when we look at trends, we're getting more compute dramatically faster than we're getting more bandwidth. And that gap just widens. So even if we got all this compute power, but we're always going to memory, we're not going to get very good performance. Right? And we're going to learn programming techniques to minimize going to global memory, but the GPU itself will do things such that when you go to global memory, it can do other useful work. So let's take a look. In fact, I'll just skip that because we'll see it in the example. So here is a set of eight fragments, and they're running their code. And then eventually, they go to global memory. Okay, but it just so happens that we have a lot of fragments. So we have a lot of groups of these fragments that we've grouped into 8. Don't worry about how we group them or even that 8 is the right size. So what we can do is we can take that context, that group of memory on a processor, and we can store the contexts for multiple groups of fragments at the same time. We're only going to be executing one of those at any given point in time. However, if one goes in the memory, or excuse me, goes to global memory and therefore can't do useful work for a few hundred cycles, well, we could just swap in a new one right away. We have everything on chip. The very next cycle, you know, this guy goes to global memory, the very next cycle, we pull in another set of fragments, and so on. So the result here is that we increase the total amount of time it will take to execute any one group of fragments, but we improve the overall throughput. Okay, what questions do you guys have about that? So it's multi-threading to hide global latency to global memory. Okay, so here's something that's going to bite us all when we write some CUDA code. On chip, say we have a chunk of memory here, it's 128K. Now this pool is dynamically partitioned. The I'll say hardware, maybe a little bit of software, can partition this however it deems fit. So for example, maybe we could have 18 small contexts. So this particular core could host up to 18 sets or groups of fragments at the same time. But maybe we could just split it into, say, 12. So now each context in this case is larger. It could have more registers, but there's less total. Or here's 4 maybe really complicated fragment shader or groups of fragment shaders that use a lot of registers. So what do you guys think is the trade-off between having more or less groups of fragments hosted on the same processor? So from looking back at this picture where we see, hey, if something stalls, we'd like to swap in a new group so we can continue to do useful work. What's better for hiding the latency from stalls? Having, say, 18 contexts or 4? If I had 18, would you agree with me that then if one of them goes to memory and we need to bring in a new one, that the chances of us having something useful work to do is more so than, say, if I only had 4 of them? Would you agree with me? And call this proof by example. I'm kidding. Don't quote me on that. So the more contexts we have, especially when you go to global memory and it could be hundreds of cycles, if we have enough other groups of fragments that have enough useful work to do, by the time we swap in that original group that was stored on memory, it's already ready to go. That memory came in on chip. So having a lot of contexts is useful. So this means that it means a couple of things. One is you have to have enough useful work to do. And so maybe shading 20 or 50 fragments isn't that good, but shading a million of them is, we have plenty of work to do. The other thing it means that if you're going to have a lot of contexts, the amount of memory each one uses is limited. So you're going to see issues of register pressure, which means that you're going to start adding variables to your code, and suddenly your performance is going to drop. And you're going to go, what happened? You know, you thought you added an optimization. Like, oh, there's all this redundant computation. I'm going to store it off in a variable. And what's going to happen is that's going to add the number of registers that you've used, and it's going to reduce your overall ability to hide memory stalls because you're going to have less context in flight at the same time. So that happened, you know. And we'll also look. NVIDIA has a cool Excel calculator that we can kind of see to predict this. But these are the kind of things that make programming the GPU harder than programming the CPU. And I think it's still, you know, efforts are being made to make programming the GPU easier, but it still takes more knowledge of the architecture and just, you know, more willingness to carefully tune your code to really get the full performance. So I'll give you some, like, off-the-cuff numbers, right? So say you have a problem that maps well to the GPU. you know, image processing is a really good one, right? Because you got a pixel comes in, pixel comes out, probably reads from a bunch of other pixels as well. If it maps really well to the GPU and it's embarrassingly parallel and it has a lot of compute relative to memory access, you might get, it's very easy to get just a 10-time performance improvement going from the CPU implementation to the GPU implementation. But then if you're able to carefully tune it for the GPU, then you might see when these people are saying, oh, we get 100 times performance improvement going from CPU to GPU. So it's really two phases. It's like parallel decomposition, composing your problem such that it can be solved in parallel, and then really optimizing for the hardware. Okay, let's see. So one thing that I want to say about this slide, you don't have to worry about every detail on this slide, but swapping threads is fast. I mean, let's not even say fast. Let's say it's free. Like, when it's going to execute the next cycle on the processor, it doesn't matter if it's coming from the same thread or another thread that's on the same processor. It's very fast. Creating threads is fast. They're not like CPU threads. So you should just think, you know, you'll hear people say threads are free. Like, they're just, you want to have a lot of them in most cases. Okay, so let's put this together into an example chip here. Now, this example chip is not exactly what you would burn in the silicon because it's showing four contexts per core. And remember, that is dynamically partitioned. So it depends on the program that's running. It could be 4, it could be 18, it could be a lot of different numbers. But this particular chip is 16 total cores, where each core has 8 ALUs, so each core can handle 8 fragments at the same time running the same program. But each core could run a different program. So that's instruction streams. Each core can do one different instruction stream, 16 total. So here, since each core can host 4 contexts, you're looking at 64 concurrent instruction streams, but only 16 of them executing at a time. And that's a total of 512 concurrent fragments. So since we got 128 ALUs, and they're capable of doing multiply adds, so the MAD is they consider one, can be done in one instruction. So 2 times 128 is 256, clock it at a gigahertz. This is a 256 gigaflops chip, which would be very modest by today. I don't know what, I think I've seen things of 2 teraflops. Has anyone bought something crazier than 2 teraflops? Okay, so tell me, looking at this picture, what questions do you guys have about this? Because we're going to spend a few lectures. When we look at just general GPU compute, not necessarily graphics, but just generally programming this parallel machine, you know, the last half hour is like the core. Like, if you understand the last half hour, the next 3 lectures are just the implementation of that through programming it through CUDA. So tell me, what questions do you have? And you guys are going to get a lot done this semester. Good. Okay, so again, the big idea is we took out all the stuff that makes a single instruction stream run quickly, that freed up transistors so that we could add a bunch of cores. We took each of those cores and we amortized the fetch decode logic over several ALUs. And then we did hardware multi-threading so that when we go to memory, or when we go to global memory, we can swap in a new thread so we're not waiting. Okay, so this is out of order. I know that this is not your last slide. It was in the middle. It was the slide that we stopped at last week. But I didn't want to introduce it too soon because we should have built up to it. So I would say I put it in the wrong place. I want to give you a quick look at this because when we start doing graphics, we're going to see that this processor, it's not just a general processor. There is some fixed function hardware in there. So here, this core we're looking at, it's got the 8 cores, or really 8 ALUs. You'll start seeing the terminology is going to start getting a little goofy. Like, right, you said you have 32 CUDA cores in that Quadro card. So that really means 32, basically you'd call it 32 ALUs, right? So you probably have 2 processors, 2 cores would be my guess. I'd have to look at the card, but probably 2. So here, this this core has got 8 ALUs, but then you see these things that say text, T-E-X. So those are fixed function hardware, meaning it can't execute general code. It is burn-in logic for reading from textures, and that does texture filtering. So you'll see bilinear filtering. It can read multiple texels or pixels in that texture and then and average them and do things like that. And that's built in the hardware. And we'll see a couple other things for a couple other functions are built in the hardware too, like in particular the rasterizer, which is the thing that figures out what fragments need to be generated from a triangle. And this is built in the hardware, not programmable, because when you burn in the hardware, it executes a whole lot faster than general purpose code, and it uses a lot less power, and it uses a lot less transistors. So as we look historically at GPUs, they were originally all fixed function. They can only do certain graphics features, and it was burnt in the hardware. And then they started to become programmable, and then when people looked at it and go, wow, this should be like super duper programmable. And there was this debate as to, well, what are we gonna do with this fixed function? Does it stay, does it not stay? And for a while, it looked like, you know, the trend was like, less fixed function, that's just it. You know, everyone just knew that. But now, with mobile and the concern for power and size, the fixed parts of the fixed function are going to be here, I would say, for the foreseeable, let's say for the next 5 years, for sure. So, talk more about that when we look at the graphics stuff. Okay, so that's it for that slide deck. Again, any just general GPU architecture, any questions about that? Okay. So we'll take the rest of today and Wednesday, and we'll talk about programming the GPU with CUDA. Okay. So these are the slides that I gave out today. Again, a number of these slides came from the guys who did the UIUC course, who also wrote the Programming Massively Parallel Processors book, if you've been reading that. So, you know, check out their website, and I think, like I said, some of the draft PDFs for their book is still on their course website. Okay, so I don't think we need too much of the review now, because we just talked about the GPU architecture, but I just want to emphasize that the right programs that really benefit from the GPU have a lot of compute relative to memory. So it's not read memory, multiply, read memory, multiply. It's like read memory, do a lot of computation, read memory, or write to memory, and so on. And we need to be able to break these problems into things that are parallel. And all the transistors, as we'll see in the next slide here, is all for compute. So here's another image. This is from NVIDIA, from the CUDA. The CUDA C programming guide, which I have linked at the bottom of the slide, which is an awesome, you know, if I didn't give you guys enough reading already, but if you want more reading, their programming guide is killer. In fact, I'd say that all of my CUDA slides come from a combination of the programming Massively Parallel Processors book and the CUDA C programming guide, and that their PDF is online, of course. And this is, you know, their kind of marketing picture of, hey, look, a regular CPU maybe has a whole lot of cache and all this control logic, and in this GPU, we throw in a whole lot more ALUs and minimize other stuff because we care about lots of instructions, not just one instruction stream. Okay, so let's talk about programming this. The way that I would describe the GPU computing history is probably about 10 years ago, we were looking at the GPU and it's like, man, you know, this thing is doing graphics, and it's really useful for graphics, and, well, what is graphics? It's a lot of vertices, a lot of pixels, they can all be processed in parallel. Well, you know, we have a bunch of other problems, say, like cloth simulation, fluid flow, image processing, and they can benefit from massively parallel processing. So if we could form our general purpose problems in graphics terminology, then maybe we could utilize the GPU to do our general problems. And this was a hot field. I mean, I would say if you wanted to get published, you could pretty much just take whatever topic you do and then append on the GPU, artificial intelligence on the GPU. encryption on the GPU, right? And there's your ticket, right? Assuming you got it to work. But this was a hack. I really have trouble understanding how people who weren't graphics programmers were able to pull this off, because you really hijacked the graphics processor, and you made, instead of shading fragments in your fragment shader, you multiplied matrices, or you did sum of Gaussians, or you did something, you know, completely not graphics, I would say. And they would render, instead of rendering models or images, they'd render full screen quads, and their textures wouldn't have images, or textures would have, say, matrices, and they had to think about problems very, very differently. And we'll probably talk a little bit about that in this course, maybe just from like a historic point of view. So when I took this course, what was that, 2007? Let's say I took it in 2007. The course was designed only to do that, only just what we call GPGPU, general purpose GPU programming. And in the middle of it, something called CUDA came out that allowed us to not hack up the graphics program, but instead program it in a more sane way. But you will see this term still used, GPGPU. Okay, so 2007, NVIDIA released CUDA, which is Compute Uniform Device Architecture. I think it also is related like to the Barracuda, the muscle car. And then the terminology kind of changed here from GPGPU to GPU computing. And CUDA allows us, we don't think about fragments anymore, we think about threads. We don't think about shaders, we think about kernels. We don't hack up our data into textures. We have a memory model that we can follow. So it really made it approachable for the non-graphics programmers, I think. And then pretty soon after that, Kronos released OpenCL for the Open Compute Library. And this is cross-platform, so CUDA only runs on NVIDIA hardware, and OpenCL runs on NVIDIA and AMD, and I assume Intel. And we did, you're free to use OpenCL. Like say, for your final project, you want to do OpenCL, you're welcome to it. For your projects that we're giving you starter code for this semester, it's all going to be in CUDA because we already know CUDA really well and we have a lot of the material. Although Carl and I were talking that maybe next year we might provide both CUDA and OpenCL. And later in the semester, I'll be curious to hear you guys' feedback, what you guys think about doing that in the future. Now, this history, I would even update it even more to say, so WebCL is a standard that brings OpenCL to the web. So you could write JavaScript code that can invoke the GPU as a general purpose massively parallel process, which is pretty cool. That will be a great technology for your final project if you guys want to do any WebCL work. I don't believe that the spec has been ratified yet, but I do think that there is an implementation that's available to use. So you'd be on the bleeding edge and you might have to deal with some driver issues and things like that. But that would be, we would take that into consideration with your project. And then also, very recently, meaning say a month ago at SIGGRAPH, OpenGL 4.3 was released, and that includes compute shaders, which is a way to do general purpose kernels in OpenGL. And that's really exciting because you can combine, say, CUDA and OpenGL or OpenCL and OpenGL, but it's really nice to have the compute shaders there because it just makes using the API a lot simpler. So there's two projects that we might do later this semester. We're still thinking about it, but one is, and these are both ones that we used to do in this course. One was the cloth simulator. I showed you guys a picture of it last week where we simulate a cloth and we do relot integration for each point in parallel in CUDA. And then we take that memory and we share it with OpenGL so that we can create a mesh and draw the cloth. And so we just simulate and render on the GPU back and forth shared memory. And then another one that we did was a flocking simulation. So if you guys are taking computer animation, you'll see flocking where you might have a bunch of birds that all fly in a certain pattern in a flocking pattern. And that's an embarrassingly parallel problem as well. So we have CUDA code for both of those that we've done in previous semesters, but we might actually port that to compute so that we can do something with OpenGL 4.3 this semester, which would be very, very cutting edge, because since it just came out. Now, I will say that Direct3D has had compute shaders for probably about 2 years now. So the idea of having a compute shader inside your graphics APIs is not new, but I'm glad that it's in OpenGL now, which I really feel brings OpenGL up to par with Direct3D. Okay, so I probably just threw like 12 different API names at you guys, right? So the most important one that I want you to remember is, for the moment, is CUDA. We're going to be looking at using CUDA to program the GPU in a general purpose way without worrying about any of the graphics details. And see me if you're interested in any of these other APIs for your final project. Compute shader stuff, WebCL, WebGL, doing graphics on the web too. Very, very cool. Okay, so there's a few big things in CUDA that we're going to talk about today, and then the follow-up lectures to CUDA are just going to be like making it go fast, really, because that's kind of why we care. I mean, if we didn't want things to go fast, we wouldn't need the GPU at all, right? Okay, so there's three big abstractions in CUDA. There's a two-level hierarchy of threads, and organizing the threads is pretty important so that they can run on the same processor or not run on the same processor or communicate with each other or not communicate with each other. There's shared memory, which is how we do the communication, and unlike global memory, it's very fast. Not quite as fast as registers. That was one slip-up I made. I'm not always correct, by the way. Last semester, I told everyone that on the G80, accessing a register and shared memory took the same amount of time, and my TA later came in and told the class that I lied to them, and the registers is one cycle and shared memory is two cycles. So if I make anything up, I will always try to fix it, hopefully in the same lecture or soon after. And then we also have barrier synchronization. So we'll look at how these threads can work with each other and then stop and make sure they all reach a synchronization point. And that's really, really important. Okay, so a little bit of terminology. In the CUDA world, your CPU is the host, and we're going to write code in C or C++. And the GPU is usually the device, or I'll say the device is usually the GPU. And that's the data parallel processor, which we're going to write in what we'll call extended C. So CUDA adds some keywords that make it so we can write the CUDA kernels to run them on the device. You might see me slip up and call these things CPUs and GPUs, but I'll try to keep the terminology consistent with host and device in the context of CUDA. For now, which is I don't believe is true in CUDA 4, but let's talk previously to CUDA 4, the host and the device have separate memories. Okay, so there's the bus everyone has, PCI Express, I hope, right, on your desktop where it's really old. And that bus is what we have to transfer data across to communicate between the host and the device. And we will see that the bus can be a really big bottleneck. So if you have, say, a very simple computation to do, and you're like, oh, you know what, this is embarrassingly parallel, I can just put it on the GPU and it'll eat it up. But your computation is like, you know, I'm going to add a vector. I have this giant vector, I'm going to add it. All the work that you're going to do to transfer the memory from the host to the device and back from the device to the host is going to flush out any gains that you get from that parallelism. So when you put something in the GPU, it needs to do enough work to make the transfer worth it in a separate memory system. And then when we write our CUDA programs, and hopefully you guys have all at least looked a little bit at the code that Carl's provided, you have both your C code that runs on the host as well as your CUDA C code that runs on the device in the same program. And I know that the code that Carl sent out, there might be like a lot of it, and you might be like, oh man, this is intimidating. Most of it you don't need to worry about at all. And a lot of the complexity there is because the CUDA kernel creates a texture that then we render with OpenGL. So the program that you guys got is more complicated than the typical Hello World CUDA C program. But it's going to be very useful for you because in your ray tracer and in your path tracer and in your rasterizer in your next three projects, you want that code. You're going to generate images, and then you want to be able to see those images and Carl already wrote that code for you, so you'll just be writing the CUDA part, which will be fun. We're definitely, your first three projects were the ray tracer, patch tracer, and rasterizer. We're super, super excited about. Okay, so a little more terminology. What we've been calling the shader, the fragment shader, now we're going to call it kernel. It's a function. It's a data parallel function. It's a function that executes across many different sets of data. And when you invoke this kernel, you create a bunch of lightweight threads. Remember, creating threads is quick. Swapping threads is quick. And the hardware does the scheduling, which makes it lightning fast. Ignore my OpenGL comment. Okay, so here's our first look at a kernel, which is definitely something I said you will not get a performance benefit doing this on the GPU, but doing only this on the GPU. However, you may need to do things like this while you're doing other stuff on the GPU, and that's completely fine. And we'll look at a number of parallel algorithms that are like that. So this particular code is valid CUDA code, and it's got a few main points here. So it just had, we have three arrays, A, B, and C, and we're going to take A and B as input, add them, and create C. So right off the bat, like if we look at this code compared to how I would write this and without CUDA, right? I mean, what do you guys notice this different right away? That weird triple less than and triple greater than thing down there? And I agree. What's maybe even bigger than that? What's this code missing? Return statement? Well, the return is implicit because C is a pointer, so if we dereference it and change that, that's fine. So someone just tell me, how would we implement this in straight C, one core? Just tell me what the code is. For loop. Where's the for loop here? So there is no for loop, right? It's implicit. When we execute this kernel, we want to run this across a whole bunch of processors. And the for loop is implicit here in that everything happens in parallel. And the index for the for loop is this thread idx.x. So that's thread index.x. And we'll see the thread index is actually multi-dimensional. So let's break this code down. The kernel, we have __global__. And that is saying, hey, this is a kernel function. That's simple. And we'll see there's a few other identifiers that we can use like this. Here, this execution configuration, for right now, we're just going to say that it's telling us how many threads. We're just going to leave it super simple for the moment. And here it's saying n threads. And then when we execute this kernel, one invocation for each thread, we have this built-in thread index ID. Don't worry about how it got assigned right now, but I promise that they're all unique, starting from 0, going up to n minus 1. And then we use that index to add together the two vectors. Pretty simple? Good. Okay, so in general, a CUDA program, you might have some code that runs on the CPU or on the host in a serial fashion. You invoke the kernel, it runs on the device, and then you might wind up doing more work on the CPU and then invoke things on the device. But when you invoke the device, that's when you get all the parallelism. That's when all your threads run, hopefully at the same time. Okay, so when I first introduced CUDA, I said that there was a 2D hierarchy of threads. So I want to explain a little bit about this hierarchy, because part of CUDA is determining how do you organize your threads into these hierarchies. And that will have implication for what threads can communicate with other threads. So the two terms here are grid and block. A grid is an organization of blocks. It could be 1D or 2D. And it's really up to you. It's up to the type of problem you're solving, if it's 1D or 2D. It doesn't matter from CUDA's point of view. It's just for you. The block is an array of threads. that can be either one-dimensional, two-dimensional, or three-dimensional. And I'll show you like pictures for when you might use each case. Yeah?
Does Grid have to be an array of blocks, or is it just randomly done? Does it have to be continuous allocation?
So you don't actually allocate these. You'll see that when you do the... when you invoke the kernel right there where it says vec add, and then it's got the triple less than and greater than, that is actually saying the dimensions for the number of blocks and the number of grids. So don't think in terms of allocating anything. It's just when you invoke it, how do you want it organized? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so each block in the grid has the same number of threads. And a thread in that block can synchronize and share the same memory. So that implies that if these guys share the same memory, then the threads in that block run on the same process. Do you guys see that? Does that make sense? Right? Like we looked at those pictures where we saw that the shared memory was on one processor. So for them to be able to share that shared memory, they all have to run on the same processor. Not necessarily at the same time, but they need to be all on the one processor so they can share that memory. So far, so good? Grids and blocks? And remember, there's no quiz. True or false, the grid can be one, two, or three-dimensional. Right, I don't care. Tell me the difference between a grid and a block. Maybe I care about that. I care about you knowing that there's two levels. Maybe, I don't care if you swap the terminology. I may swap the terminology. So I want you to get the concepts and don't get bogged down in every little detail. If there is no test, don't worry. Well, he asked me about this.
So a bunch of threads makes one block, and that goes to one processor.
Exactly.
And then there's many blocks in
it. Exactly. Yep, it's that simple. I mean, if you even want to break it down, you can just ignore that I said 2D or 3D. A block is an array of threads, a grid is an array of blocks. And here's a concrete example where we see the host. It invokes two different kernels. Kernel 1 has a 2D grid, 3 over by 2 down. And each block is 5 by 3 threads. And you'll see they have the indexes there where it will actually be the thread index so that we could use the index into our own data. And then each kernel can organize these however they want. But the organization here, one is the organization within the block is up to you to help you read from your data structures. The number of threads in the block or the size of the grid will have impact on scheduling. And that will be mostly next... I'd say mostly Wednesday. We'll talk about that. Okay, so within the block, you have an array of threads. How can we organize them? One thing that we could do is, say we're working with vectors like we just did in that last example. Just a 1D array is fine. Is how we want to index them. Or say we're dealing with matrices, 2D is fine, X and Y. And volumes, say you have volumetric data from a CAT scan or MRI, 3D. And we'll look at examples for, I'd say, definitely 1D and 2D. It might be a 3D one in there, too. Okay, so the thread index is what's built in the CUDA, and that when your kernel gets invoked, this thread index, or thread IDX, I'm just going to call it thread index, that is already assigned by the runtime. And then the thread ID is maybe a term that I don't want to say I made it up, but it's definitely common enough that basically the thread ID is something that you usually would derive from the thread index to read from your arrays. Because we will see some example of passing in multidimensional arrays, but a lot of times we jam our data into some 1D array, and then we compute some thread index from or thread ID from the thread index, and then we read into the array. So for a 1D array, you might just take the thread index and read into the array. For a 2D one, you might go, in this case, we're looking at row major, where we're taking the Y value and multiplying it by the dimension of the block. and then we're adding on the X value. So it's going down one. That's, that would be stored in row major. And then for 3D, you can do something similar to go across the X, Y, and Z components. But the real takeaway that I want you guys to see here is that each thread gets a unique index, and then you use that index to read into your data structures. Okay, so here's an example. It's a pretty simple example with 2D arrays and with 2D arrays and 2D thread indexes. So here we're doing one thread per number of blocks. We're just doing one block. So the grid is 1 by 1. And we have a 2D block here, which is N by N. So you could just, if concrete numbers help you, you could think that N is 4, N is 16, or something like that. And then here, since we passed in 2D arrays, this is really easy. We don't even do that multiply that we saw on the previous slide. We're just pulling out the X and Y, and we're adding a matrix. So we just changed our code from adding a vector to adding a matrix by just looking at two dimensions instead of one. And again, this problem is still embarrassingly parallel. Right, every element can be read in parallel. Then when we write the data, when we write to C, I, J there, there's no write conflicts. Okay, so we'll talk a lot more about this, but you might just go, okay, this is sounding pretty good. Maybe I can put a whole lot of threads in my block. Because you said that if threads are in a block, well, they have shared memory, and therefore they can communicate with each other, and they can synchronize with each other, and that sounds like a useful thing to do. Well, we only have so much context space on a given core. We can only put so many registers in there. There's only so much fast memory on that core. So there's hardware limitations. Now, on NVIDIA, the G80, which is like the first generation CUDA cards, which is a lot of what we'll be talking about early in the semester here. And on the GT200, which was the next generation, you can put up to 512 threads in one block. Okay, then on the Fermi, which was their next generation, which is one behind the current generation of Kepler. I forgot, there will be a quiz. There's no quiz. You can put up to 1,024 threads. Right, so there's trade-offs here, so you got to realize you can only put so many threads in a block. And you might want to be careful as to how many threads you put in there, because then you can only only use so much memory from each one or so many registers. So here's an image where we're looking, and we're really going to cover the memory model on Wednesday. But here's kind of like a little preview where we have two different threads. Okay, they're in green at the bottom, and they each have their own set of registers. So think of that. You know, that's your local variable. In I equals 5. You know, in J equals 2.0. So each thread sees its own registers. It doesn't see anyone else's registers. But they both, since they're both on the same core, they can both access the same shared memory. And they'll have to synchronize if they're going to be using the same values in the shared memory. And we'll see how to do that. So far, so good? Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the block index. So we said that there's a grid, and that's a 1D or 2D set of blocks. So there's built-in variables for the block index, as well as the total block dimensions. Is it, you know, 3 by 2, 1 by 1, you know, whatever. And what we can do is we can actually build an index into our data structure, not just based on the block ID. But if we have multiple blocks in our grid, then we also want to take into account the, not just on the thread ID, we also want to take into account the block ID. Okay, so, and we have to do this because we can only make the blocks so big. So say we're on G80 and we only have 512 threads. That means that in our vector add example, we can only add a vector of 512 elements. Right, so what would we do? Would we just invoke a bunch of separate kernels? I don't think that's not nearly as efficient because, geez, I thought that what our processor that we made in the last set of slides, what could that do? How many fragments did that do concurrently? 512 or something like that? So we really want to saturate that. And that is a toy example. You can do a lot more. You know, we'll look at some of the limits, but like on a G80, you know, it's tens of thousands of threads. It might be it's 30,000, I think, on the GT200. So you don't just want to launch one kernel with 512 threads. So we split it across blocks. So this example is the matrix add example. Only it can do more than a total of 512 elements because we have multiple blocks in a grid. So here we define threads per block, 16 by 16. Okay, so that's a 2D block, 16 by 16. But we have a total of n by n in terms of the number of elements in each matrix. So we make the grid size, you know, n divided by 16 in both directions. Okay. Ooh. And then you'll see indexing up here, we have to consider both the block dimensions and the block index. So we kind of use the block dimensions to skip over a whole chunk of the elements. And I'll show you an example on this next slide here. And the easiest thing to do is you just got to crank on this a little bit in your code, and you'll get it right. But say, you know, we had 16 by 16 threads per block, and the thread index there in both x and y will go from 0 to 15, 0 to 15. And then let's just say, in the case of n equals 32, the grid is 2 by 2, so you have a total of 4 blocks, one in each corner for the matrix. And those block indexes, they're either going to be 0 or 1, and the block dimension is 16 here. So when the block index is 0, the I and j just become the thread x and thread y. All right, and then when block index is 1 for either, or block index is 1 for either x and y, then you skip over that whole chunk. All right, so it's just some simple 2D indexing here. And we're going to use this. We're kind of going to go through, so we've been looking at matrix add. We're going to go through matrix multiply a good bit. Yep. Yeah, good question. So number of blocks, this dim 3 on the left-hand side, that's a vector 3. So it's got an x, y, and z component, except the z component is ignored for the grids.
Right. So my question is, like, n may not be divisible by threads per block, right?
Oh, yeah, this is in PowerPoint. It's always divisible. And so you're right. You have to deal with those edge cases in your code. But in PowerPoint, I get away with anything.
Oh, okay.
So for you to go through this code for your learning, just think like n is 32, as I show on the following slide here. But absolutely, in your code, you deal with the reality of life, and the devil is in the details. Okay, let's see. We'll talk a little bit about. It sounds pretty good to put threads in the same block, because then they can synchronize and they can share memory, right? Good. But all of the threads, all the blocks are independent of each other. So you can't synchronize across blocks for right now. We will see that there are ways to do it with atomics to global memory, but they're slow. So if each block can't synchronize with each other, then we can execute them in any order that we want, which means that if we have a whole lot of processors, a whole lot of cores, we might take all your blocks for your kernel and execute them at the same time. Now, if we're on that Quadro card and it's got 32 cores, we might not be able to execute all your blocks at the same time. We might have to make blocks wait before we can put them on that core. So here's an example. At the top here, we got 8 blocks. And on the left, we got this poor 2-core GPU. And remember, each core probably has 8 ALUs, probably 8 ALUs. So in that case, we're only doing 2 blocks at a time. Now, over time, a new GPU comes out. It's got more cores. And suddenly, our code is faster because we're getting more parallelism out of it. And this is, I don't want to call this like the free lunch. Right, have you guys read The Free Lunch Is Over? That Herb Sutter paper from, like, I think it was 2003 or so. I was thinking about making it a reading in this semester, but The Free Lunch Is Over you could Google it. It's online. I think, I forget where he originally wrote it for. It might have been in, like, the C++ Journal, but it was talking about how in the 90s, the clock frequency just kept going up in CPUs. Memory kept getting bigger. We kept getting all this innovation in terms of out of order execution, and we would write code and it would just run faster next year. It's like, oh, do you want to pay a programmer to optimize this, or do you want to wait 6 months for the new processor? And now we really don't see that with CPUs, right? Which is because it's all about the parallelism, not just in the GPU, but even the CPU, we're very interested in parallelism. So here on the GPU, I don't want to make the claim that, hey, look, the free lunch is back, but definitely if you have a really parallel program that's got a lot of compute to memory ratio, when you run it on a machine with more cores, you're likely to get more performance. And you'll see the theme, I don't know, probably 300 times in this semester, I will say, compute to memory ratio, and embarrassingly parallel. Yep?
Like, what does it mean, CUDA cores?
Yeah, so, it could be, you know, it could be either. So you could look at the core, meaning the entire processor that has the fetch and decode and the context and all. That definitely will help. And sometimes you will see, as we will see from GA to Fermi, where they double the number of CUDA cores or ALUs from 16 to 32. And by the way, this calling the ALU a core, that gets, some people get really angry about that. And they go, this CUDA core is total marketing. I can't believe people say that. And that's crazy. So you got to be careful, like when you go apples to apples and you go, okay, this is the Intel CPU, it's got 8 cores, and this is the NVIDIA GPU, it's got 2,000 cores. The cores are not the same thing, right? In the NVIDIA or in the GPU term, they're really just talking about these ALUs, right? So, because you couldn't make a full CPU, you couldn't put 2,000 cores on the same die, right? You just don't have enough transistors. What other questions you guys have? Okay, so the threads in the same block, you're going to see that they can access the shared memory, like we said. And we're going to talk about barrier synchronizations, where basically they can all work with shared memory, and then they all stop. They go, hey, everyone, wait till we get here, and then we can use each other's memory that we all brought in together. And we're going to look at some examples on Wednesday for doing that. Okay, so in addition to registers per thread that are only visible to the thread and only at the lifetime of the kernel, you have the shared memory, which are visible to all the threads in the block. And then you have some other things. Global memory. Anyone can see global memory. And even if you launch multiple kernel invocations, one of them can output to global memory and the next one can read from it. And when we initially launch a kernel, like those arrays for, say, the vector add, we'll put them in the global memory. The kernels will read from them. They'll put the data back in the global memory, and then the CPU or the host can read it. The problem with global memory, because it sounds so convenient, is it's really slow, and it's off-chip. It's off-chip, but it's almost definitely on the board. So just so the terminology is clear. And then there's these other things that sound pretty interesting, like local memory. You go, local memory sounds good. So local memory is local to the thread, but it's stored in global memory. So it turns out to be really slow to access it. At least on the G80. There may be some cases where it's faster. Like, for example, constant memory is for storing constant data, and that's really slow to access unless all threads in a block are accessing the same value at the same time, the same location at the same time. So, and we'll talk more about the memory model, but this slide right here is a pretty good bird's eye view of the memory model, because I want to talk about transferring data from the host into the device and vice versa, so we can start filling out the simple kernels that we looked at today. Okay, so when we're in the host, we can transfer to the device either to global memory or to constant memory, and we're pretty much always going to be doing it to global memory. We can use constants, but the common case is going to be global memory because we might want to read and write to it. And again, remember, this goes over the PCI Express bus. I will tell you, before the PCI Express, do you guys know the difference between the PCI Express and an AGP, for example? Like, perhaps the biggest difference? Have you guys heard of AGP? Maybe you're AGP might have, so the buses have, you know, have evolved over the years, and AGP used to be like in the late 90s, maybe that was where all the graphics cards would run on the AGP bus. And then maybe your slow devices, like a network card, would run on PCI. And then they came out with PCI Express. And the big difference between AGP and PCI Express, which is very important for us in this class, is that the AGP had a lot more bandwidth going to the device than coming back up. Whereas the PCI Express, you get the same amount of bandwidth going to the card and coming back. So that's really good for us if the transfer is ever a bottleneck, which it can be. Okay, so I'll just introduce a couple functions here, and if you want to allocate global memory on the devices, don't use malloc, use CUDA malloc, so that you go through the CUDA library. And then also please free your memory with CUDA free. Here's some pretty simple code here. It's just like malloc. When you allocate it, give it the size in bytes that you're going to allocate. Okay, so here we are doing something that is width by width, so n by n, 16 by 16 if you want. And then notice the multiply by size of float. So this way we're allocating the number of bytes, not just the number of floats. You'll see the double, the cast to avoid star, which is kind of a pain. And you'll notice that it takes a pointer to a pointer such that it can change your first pointer, if you're following me. And that's so the return value, I think it probably returns null if it can't allocate the memory. And then you'll notice the D suffix on these is just a naming convention that the authors of our book use for device. So you can name things wherever you want, but that's what you'll see a lot of the example code uses. Okay. So in addition to the malloc and free, there's memcopy functions. And these are what we use to transfer data to and from the host. So you can go host to host, if you feel like it. Host to device, very common. Bring the data back, device to host, and also device to device, staying on the video card. Very cool. And when we do interop between, say, CUDA and OpenGL for rendering, it's all about staying on the video card. Like we're doing that flocking, and you compute new positions for all the birds in your CUDA kernel. You don't want to bring that back to the CPU. You want to leave all those positions on the video card and be like, here, OpenGL, draw this, and then continue. And you might not have to copy it too. Definitely in the compute shaders for OpenGL 4.3, I don't think you even need any kind of copying for that. Okay, so when you call CUDA memcopy, the last argument says, well, what direction are you doing? And here we're going host to device, and you'll see it's destination, source for the first two arguments. So it's the same as memcopy if you guys have done some C recently. And, so usually when I do the animations, I'd make each slide a separate animation. So this way, like when I print it out, there's no secrets, you know, that you don't see on the printout, except you might wind up flipping your pages a lot. I'll have to figure out. Maybe I'll minimize my total animations. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to go through matrix multiply. We're going to look at some naive ways to do it on the GPU, then we're going to look at some ways to optimize it. And I think that it's a really good example for just getting us thinking about how do we divide up into blocks and grids. How do we think about using shared memory? Why do we even need shared memory? And it's a really simple, embarrassingly parallel problem. We only have a few minutes left now, so I don't want to start it because we definitely won't finish it in these 5 minutes. But I'll let you guys go, and then please, if you don't have project one done, Carl's got office hours tomorrow. Get him to help you get your stuff compiling. See you guys.